Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. In this episode, we're continuing the story of Queen Elizabeth I of England. If you didn't listen to the previous episode, you really should, by the way, or the episode over her father, Henry VIII, again, you should listen to that one, then here's what you need to know. Elizabeth is the Queen of England. It was a bit of a rough journey for her to get there. Her father divorced and killed his way through a couple of wives in order to get a son. Elizabeth was the daughter of Henry's second wife, Anne Boleyn. When Henry died, his only son Edward was made king. When Eddie died without any children, the throne went to Elizabeth's older half-sister, Mary. There had been a bit of a spat involving a separate relative named Jane Grey, but Mary was indeed the queen. Well, England was now a Protestant nation, especially with further reforms under Edward, but Mary was raised as a Catholic and was really looking to reverse the Protestant Reformation's hold on her kingdom. Well, Mary would also die childless, and with the support of Mary's husband, Elizabeth ascended to the throne. Things seemed to be going all right. Elizabeth was able to once more get England back on track with Protestantism while also not completely alienating the Catholics who lived in her realm. It wasn't a perfect existence, but it was better than outright fighting. However, machinations to see Elizabeth kicked out of power were brewing beyond England's borders, especially when it came to another Mary, this one being the Queen of Scotland. So this episode will really focus on the conflict between Queen Elizabeth and Mary, Queen of Scots. It's a dangerous time to be a queen on the island of Great Britain. How will things shake out? So without further ado, let's continue the story. We're going back in time to England at the height of the Renaissance in the 16th century in The Age of Elizabeth, Part 2, God Save the Queen. Let's meet Mary, the Queen of Scotland. She was born in 1542 to King James V of Scotland and his wife, Mary of Guise. The older Mary was from a very powerful French noble family. James V happened to be the son of James IV, obviously, and Margaret Tudor, who just so happened to be the older sister of King Henry VIII of England. If my family relationship names are correct, I believe this would make Mary Queen of Scots and Elizabeth first cousins once removed. Only 6 days into her life, Mary became the Queen of Scotland when James V passed away, all of his previous children having also died. Obviously, a baby can't rule the nation, so there was a brief battle over who would be the regent to the throne until Mary came of age. For the first 2 years of her life, this battle was between a bishop who claimed that James had named him regent, a claim everyone disputed as false, and a Scottish earl who was next in line to the throne if the infant Mary died. After a while, it kind of became obvious that the earl had won that argument. In 1554, Mary's mother finally managed to settle the dispute by naming herself as the regent. But moving back a bit to 1543, when Henry VIII learned about the birth of his niece and her immediate ascension to the Queen of Scotland, he began formulating a plan. He was actually looking to expand England's power by taking over Scotland, but he hid this behind a marriage proposal between Mary and his son Edward. Yes, they were cousins, but this was medieval royalty, so yeah, that'll happen. The agreement, called the Treaty of Greenwich, proclaimed that when Mary turned 10 years old, she would be married to Edward. Provided that the couple had a child together, the two kingdoms, England and Scotland, would essentially be merged into one power but as two legally distinct nations. This marriage never ended up coming to pass for several reasons, which I talked about last episode, mainly Edward dying. The Scottish Parliament was also vehemently against the treaty, so it was never ratified. So maybe that was more important than Edward dying. The failed marriage, among other larger political happenings, led to several years of war between England and Scotland. In order to protect the queen, in 1547, Mary was hidden away in a nunnery while her government looked to France for assistance. The King of France, Henry II, stepped in and decided that in order to solidify bonds between Scotland and France, Mary should get engaged to his 3-year-old son. It wasn't until close to a year after the proposal was offered that the Scottish Parliament agreed to the union. Mary was sent away to live in France. By 1550, hostilities between England and Scotland had ended, with the Scottish-French alliance coming out on top over England. Meanwhile, Mary was being educated in the royal palace, learning multitudes of languages, literature, dance, falconry, and many other skills deemed necessary to the life of royalty. Apparently everyone, except for her future mother-in-law, adored the Queen of Scotland. She and her future husband, the future King Francois II, were quite an interesting couple. From an outsider's perspective, the pair could not have been any more different. Mary was very tall for a medieval Scottish woman, 5'11", about 1.8 meters tall, and very eloquently spoken. Francois, on the other hand, was very short for a Frenchman and spoke with a stutter. However, the pair were said to have gotten along very well, even from their earliest days of knowing each other. In April of 1558, just under a month before she and Francois were to be married, Mary signed an agreement with the French government that would shake up things in the future. Per the agreement, should Mary die without having any children, the French royal family would receive her titles. Obviously, they meant they would receive Scotland. However, as a not-too-distant relation to the current Queen of England, the other Queen Mary, who was very much childless and not doing so well health-wise, Mary, Queen of Scots, also threw in the throne of England as part of her agreement. Obviously, France was gunning for this agreement to go through. From the very early days of her reign, Queen Elizabeth was incredibly wary of her northern counterpart. Mary was one of her closest living relatives, meaning that any claim she made for the throne actually held a fair bit of merit. There was also the whole factor of France having a military presence in Scotland, and the former nation now really gunning for Elizabeth to get ousted so they could be one step closer to seizing power over all of Britain. The year after both Mary's marriage to Francois and Elizabeth's own ascension to Queen of England, King Henry II of France passed away from injuries he received in a jousting tournament. It was a really nasty death caused by both an eye infection and brain damage. I'll let you work out the mental image there. So now, Mary was both Queen of Scotland and Queen of France, leading to even more pressure over the entire situation. However, Elizabeth's power was able to maintain hold due to the whole Protestant Reformation wave that was still going on across Europe. England was a steadfast Protestant nation. Scotland was also currently undergoing its own Reformation. In 1560, a group of Protestant nobles took control of the government. This group, known as the Lords of the Congregation, were not super altogether with the whole Franco-Scots alliance. While Mary was off in France being queen, her mother was holding down the fort of Catholic control by using the previously mentioned French army. Unfortunately, in July of 1560, Mary's mother passed away. The Scottish Protestants sent word to Elizabeth that now would be probably a good time to send some of her good Protestant English soldiers north of the border to help them gain further control of the nation. The Catholics in Scotland looked to France for aid, but several political upheavals on the French home front made sending more troops an impossible feat. The Scottish government, particularly under the command of the Lords of the Congregation, quickly got to work arranging a treaty that would see any sort of violence suppressed. The treaty, known as the Treaty of Edinburgh, was actually between England and France. The terms of the treaty would mainly see England and France withdraw their troops from Scotland. However, the treaty also stipulated that Mary would not be able to use symbols associated with England or Ireland, which at this point was under English control, in the heraldry for the Scottish throne. Now remember, this is all coming in the wake of the death of Mary's mother, so she really wasn't in any sort of mood to interact with the legislation. She also would have been against the Treaty of Edinburgh from the start because it officially declared Elizabeth as the true Queen of England. And to top the year of 1560 off to an absolutely horrible end for Mary, in December, Francois passed away. The throne of France would pass on to Francois's younger brother, thus ending Mary's tenure as queen consort. With Mary back in Scotland, the question came as to who would be her next husband, because that's just how things go when you're a royal. We'll get to that in a moment, though. Meanwhile, the queen was still facing an uphill battle against the Protestants who had taken control of her kingdom. Three quarters of her personal council were Protestants, and it seemed as if Mary had no desire to actually go about replacing them. It seemed like she was more into figuring out how she would become the Queen of England rather than figuring out how to be Queen of Scotland. Mary even sent an envoy to Elizabeth to seek out whether the former ever stood a chance of inheriting the throne. Elizabeth, who was still unmarried and childless, admitted that Mary probably had the strongest claim to be heir at this moment in time. But the Queen of England was absolutely against ever seeing that happen. When a chance at negotiations broke down in 1562, Mary finally decided to put active attempts at seizing power in England aside for the moment in order to find a new husband. Mary's maternal uncle, a cardinal in France, quickly got to work behind his niece's back to set her up with Archduke Carl II of Austria. When Mary found out about his scheme, she intervened and the proposal fell apart. Besides, she already had set her eyes on Carlos, the son of King Felipe II of France, aka Elizabeth's former brother-in-law. In order to get her own hands in this business, Elizabeth decided that she would pair Mary with Robert Dudley. In the last episode, I talked all about how Dudley and the Queen were very close, to the point where it seemed like they were gonna get married, but never did. Luckily, both parties, Mary and Dudley, were very against the idea, so that never amounted to anything. Mary's choice of husband ended up being her paternal half-cousin Henry Stuart, because of course we had to add cousin marriage to the story, at least a successful one at this point. Mark it off on your bingo cards, everyone. Henry was also a descendant of Margaret Tudor, meaning he was also technically in the running for the English monarchy. And like Mary, Henry was Catholic. This union made Elizabeth even more nervous because, with their combined chances at the throne, any child they had would quickly move up the ranks. Remember that for later. Also, Henry was her cousin and an English subject. She had not given him permission to marry the Queen of Scotland. Elizabeth aside, the couple were married in July of 1565. The Catholic Queen's marriage to a Catholic husband sent the Protestant lords of Scotland into a frenzy, one of those major lords happening to be Mary's half-brother, James Stuart. For the next few months, an army led by the Protestant lords chased an army controlled by Mary around Scotland, though the two armies would never actually meet in person to fight. Therefore, that whole weird situation has become known as the Chaseabout Raid. Meanwhile, Henry was hoping to expand his power in Scotland and requested to be named co-sovereign. Because you see, when the king or queen consort outlives their spouse, the actual monarch, the throne just moves on to the next heir. We saw this happen with Mary in France. Well, Mary had a lot on her plate at that moment and outright refused Henry's request. This caused an incredible amount of strain on the couple's marriage. By October, things with the Chaseabout Raid had gotten so bad that Mary had to cross over into England to seek asylum for a few months. However, by that point, Mary was pregnant. With the state of their marriage, Henry was slightly convinced that he wasn't actually the father. In fact, of March of 1566, he conspired with several other lords to have the man he believed to be Mary's secret lover killed at a party in front of the Queen. it seems like this murder got Henry back on track and supportive of his wife, which, like, okay, you do you, man. And finally, in June of 1566, the son of Mary and Henry was born. He would be named after Mary's father, James. Elizabeth's worst fear had come true. Despite the birth of their son, Mary and Henry soon once more became distant with each other. In November of 1566, Mary and several of her council members met to discuss what needed to be done about Henry, as the royal couple was clearly not something Scotland wanted to be dealing with. While it was most likely that the discussion simply ended with, "Hey, Mary, you just gotta divorce this guy," there are conspiracy theories that Mary and the other nobles decided that Henry could be dealt with in other ways. Soon after this meeting, James was baptized. After that, Henry left Mary and James to stay at one of his father's estates in Glasgow, most likely out of fear for the public opinion surrounding him. During the trip, he was struck by some form of serious illness and was forced to prolong his stay. After about a couple months, Mary demanded that Henry move back to Edinburgh to continue his recuperation. He was moved to a repurposed monastery in the city, and it's said that Mary visited him every day. However, in the middle of the night on the 9th of February, Henry's recovery spot was attacked. There was apparently an explosion of some sort. And when help came to save Henry, they instead found him dead in the gardens, killed by strangulation. Due to the fact that Henry was clearly murdered, and the fact that it was kind of public knowledge that Mary was planning on probably divorcing him, or getting rid of him in some other way, it was only a matter of time before people started pointing fingers. Mary herself and several other high-ranking nobles were brought under suspicion. Rumors ran far and wide throughout all of Great Britain. It got to the point where Queen Elizabeth sent a letter to her cousin to address them. She wrote, "Men say that, instead of seizing the murderers, you are looking through your fingers while they escape, that you will not seek revenge on those who have done you so much pleasure, as though the deed would never have taken place had not the doers of it been assured of impunity. For myself, I beg you to believe that I would not harbor such a thought." Eventually, all fingers started pointing at a man named James Hepburn, the Earl of Bothwell. It had been rumored for several months that Mary and Bothwell had been having an affair behind Henry's back. One of the most pointed to stories was that the Queen decided to visit Hepburn while he was recovering from injuries sustained in a fight against a thief. When Mary's father-in-law attempted to bring Hepburn to court, not enough evidence was found that could convict him of the crime. In the aftermath of his acquittal, Hepburn gathered a group of noblemen and made them agree to back his attempts to marry the Queen of Scotland. In April of 1567, Hepburn and several other men abducted Mary after she was visiting James, her son. Though we don't know what happened, the general consensus is that Hepburn probably sexually assaulted her. Very soon afterwards, Hepburn divorced his wife. Oh yeah, by the way, Hepburn was Protestant, that'll be important. On the 15th of May, Mary and Hepburn were married in a Protestant wedding, and I really don't know why she went along with this, besides the fact that they had already been seeing each other because, I mean, yeah, there's clearly a lot going on there. There was an immediate public uproar from the Catholics of Scotland who did not recognize Hepburn's divorce or support a Protestant wedding for their queen. Public opinion against Hepburn was also incredibly strained, as he was still believed to be the man who had murdered Mary's previous husband. Very soon, a group of 26 noblemen revolted, raising an army to take down the queen and her new husband. Though Mary and Hepburn gathered troops to fight against the nobles, when the two armies finally met exactly 1 month after the royal wedding, almost the entirety of Mary's army defected to the revolting nobles. Hepburn was for some reason allowed to escape, but Mary was captured by the nobles and imprisoned in Loch Leven Castle, which is a castle in the middle of a lake. A month after her imprisonment, she miscarried a pair of twins. On the 24th of July, Mary was forced to abdicate the throne of Scotland in favor of her son. James was only 1 year old when he became king. About 11 months after she was imprisoned, Mary was freed from Loch Leven via the help of the brother of the man who owned the castle. During imprisonment, James Stuart, Mary's half-brother, had taken over Scotland as the regent of his nephew, the other James Stuart. And those surnames are actually spelled differently despite being pronounced the same. Mary raised an army that should have been able to overcome that of her half-brothers, but she was defeated in the ensuing battle and was forced to flee south into England. Elizabeth allowed her to stay in England but was cautious of giving her cousin complete freedom. There were still many questions that needed to be answered as far as the death of Henry Stuart was concerned. So, in the autumn of 1568, a council was convened in the city of York in order to finally discover whether or not Mary was guilty of any crime. Mary refused to attend the trial, but Elizabeth also forbade her from attending anyways, so I guess that was a moot point. Despite Mary's supporters in Scotland waging a revolution against him, James Stuart, her half-brother, decided to attend the trial. With him, he brought one of the most divisive pieces of evidence that has existed. It was a series of letters, contracts, and poems that altogether are referred to as the Casket Letters, named so because they were found in a small silver casket bearing the monogram of Francois, Mary's first husband. The casket letters were allegedly all from Mary to James Hepburn, declaring her love and desire to be with him. The veracity of these letters has been called into question essentially since they were first introduced up until the modern day. Unfortunately, the letters were destroyed, with some people suggesting this was done so by Mary's son, so we can't even get a better look at them. Mary herself immediately called out the letters as forgeries. I guess the general consensus today, at least by Mary's primary biographers, is that the letters were in fact, at the very least, partially falsified. Unfortunately, the English lords in charge of the trial were not so easily willing to believe so. For what it's worth, Elizabeth decided not to convict Mary. However, she also did not fully acquit her. James Stuart was allowed to return to Scotland, where he would get to run a Protestant government. Mary would remain under castle arrest in England. Starting in late January of 1569, Mary was placed under the care of George Talbot, the Earl of Shrewsbury. Though she was still under constant watch, the former Queen of Scotland would be able to freely travel to any of Shrewsbury's castles or estates. Talbot's holdings were chosen because they were halfway between the border with Scotland and London, as well as being fairly landlocked. Elizabeth was allowing Mary safety, but she was still incredibly cognizant of the latter's desires for the throne of England. In May of that year, Elizabeth attempted negotiations to see Mary restored to the throne of Scotland, with the heavy caveat that Scotland remained Protestant, but those negotiations fell flat. Then, in January of 1570, James Stuart, Mary's half-brother, not her son, was assassinated. In the aftermath of James's death, both England and Scotland went into a frenzy. Catholics in England started revolting in favor of Mary. The Catholics in Scotland, who had already been revolting against James Stuart, pushed back even harder. It took Elizabeth sending English troops into Scotland to suppress all the fighting and put an end to that current line of pro-Mary sentiment. But it would be far from the end of the long trials ahead, and many more plots would arise before things were settled for good. Later, in 1571, a plot was attempted to assassinate Elizabeth and put Mary on the throne of England. The man behind the plot was an Italian banker and noble named Roberto Ridolfi, who hoped to see England once more become a Catholic nation. His plan would have seen a Spanish army invade England via the Netherlands, which Spain owned part of back in the 16th century. the Spanish army would join up with an army raised by the Catholic noble still in England. Elizabeth would be killed, and Mary would end up as Queen of England, also marrying one of Elizabeth's Catholic cousins to help cement the deal. The Ridolfi plot is especially notable because a bunch of major figures throughout Europe got on board with the plan. Obviously, Mary agreed to it. The Spanish ambassador to England was in on it. King Felipe II, aka the guy who originally helped Elizabeth get on the throne, was in on it. Pope Pius V was even a conspirator. The plan ultimately failed due to a couple reasons. Elizabeth's spy network was always ready to pick up on plots like this. But perhaps more importantly, Ridolfi himself just went around Europe openly talking about his plan. When the Grand Duke of Tuscany, who was sympathetic to Elizabeth's reign, found out about the plot, he sent word to the Queen of England. Elizabeth had the plot put down, and her cousin, who was supposed to become Mary's husband, was sentenced to death. Over the next several years, other plots to replace Elizabeth with Mary were discovered and put down. After a failed plot in 1583, legislation was passed to further protect Elizabeth from assassination and severely punish anyone convicted of attempting to end her reign. Finally, in 1584, Mary herself attempted to put any ill will to rest with an announcement. In what is now called the Association, Mary suggested she would return to Scotland to rule alongside her son James. Scotland's Protestant leanings would remain in place, and Mary would stop trying to see herself become Queen of England. The two nations, England and Scotland, would also form a general alliance against France. While King James originally agreed to the association, Elizabeth was very much against it. She feared that Mary would form an alliance with Spain, as England and Spain were now political enemies. Elizabeth also did not believe that Mary would actually stop her aspirations for the English throne. Also, if Elizabeth let Mary go, it would make the public think she believed Mary was innocent of conspiring to kill Henry Stuart, her late husband. Elizabeth had to, at least publicly, remain on the fence over whether or not Mary was involved with that murder. Eventually, James also decided against the association and sided with Elizabeth. In 1585, after yet another assassination plot, Mary was put under tighter house arrest. After she then made the mistake of going along with yet another plot against Elizabeth in 1586, Mary was arrested. In the ensuing trial, Mary denied any involvement with the plot and insisted the trial was stacked against her. Also, as a Scottish noblewoman, she was not an English citizen and couldn't be convicted of treason against the English throne. Out of 36 nobles who were part of the prosecution, only one made any notice of hesitation in sentencing Mary to death for her part in sanctioning the death of Queen Elizabeth. Elizabeth herself was uncertain of how to deal with things going forward. Obviously, Mary had been a thorn in her side for years and had once again actively plotted to see her dead. However, Mary had once been the Queen of Scotland, was the mother of the current King of Scotland, and had many friends in the courts of mainland Europe. What would happen if she openly gave the order to have another queen killed? She was in an alliance with James, but would that hold up? Finally, in early February of 1587, Elizabeth signed the decree to have Mary executed. Soon afterward, Elizabeth's private counsel took it upon themselves to schedule the execution, something that should have been done by the queen. On the 7th of February, Mary was told she would be executed the following day. Surely enough, on the 8th of February, the council descended on Fotheringay Castle, where Mary was being held. She was beheaded, after which the executioner cried out, "God save the Queen." In order to prevent anyone from looting the final site of Mary's life, everything involved with the execution, including the clothes Mary herself wore, were burned in the fireplace of the castle's great hall. When Elizabeth found out about the execution, she became very distraught. She even punished several members of her council, including locking one away in the Tower of London. It's uncertain whether or not Elizabeth was actually upset about this turn of events, but it luckily gave her the public image of someone who had not actually been involved in the death of Mary, Queen of Scots. Despite Mary's desires to be buried in France, her remains were given a Protestant burial service and replaced in Peterborough Cathedral in eastern England. In 1612, her son would eventually see Mary's body move to Westminster Cathedral. So, still not France or Scotland, but at least somewhere befitting British nobility. Also, her tomb happens to be just 30 feet away from that of Queen Elizabeth herself. The death of Mary, Queen of Scots, did not mean that the rest of Elizabeth's reign went smoothly. There were countless wars and various conflicts, especially with Spain, that plagued the latter half of Elizabeth's time as queen. Close confidants in her personal circle, both friends and members of her council, passed away. The newer generation who filled their shoes were more inclined to create separate factions, causing further internal strife within the government. And throughout all of this, Elizabeth still had not named an heir. She was unmarried and hadn't given birth to any children. It left a massive hole within the framework of the monarchy. However, Robert Cecil, the man in charge of the day-to-day of the English government, recognized that something needed to be done. There was one obvious choice for who should be named as Elizabeth's successor, even if the queen herself was not willing to say it. The man whose existence from birth had been an omen of a new ruling dynasty in England, King James VI of Scotland. Starting in 1601, Cecil and James contacted each other secretly to negotiate terms that would see James inherit the throne of England. It's unknown how Elizabeth would have felt if she knew this was being plotted behind her back. She liked James well enough. He was a fellow Protestant and ruled the neighboring nation. Despite all the trouble with his mother, James and Elizabeth got along well. With Cecil's help, James kept a pleasant correspondence going between himself and Elizabeth. And even though she would never formally name him as her successor, it seemed as if her attitude implied consent. On the morning of the 24th of March, 1603, Elizabeth passed away. James was named as her successor later that day. He arrived in London in early May and was crowned in late July as King James I of England. Now, it should be noted that he was still King of Scotland, but the two nations remained separated. So, historically, he is known as King James VI and I. This moment, known as the Union of the Crowns, created a bizarre situation where two nations held a single monarch, and it would remain that way until Queen Anne's government in 1707 passed the Acts of Union that created the nation of the United Kingdom. And obviously, James's ascension to King of England meant the ruling dynasty of England was no longer the Tudors, but the Stuarts, who would rule the island of Great Britain until 1714. And so that brings an end to the story of Queen Elizabeth, along with Mary, Queen of Scots. Elizabeth's reign was a tumultuous period for England. It saw countless years of conflict as well as flourishing of the arts, particularly theater. But most importantly, Elizabeth helped solidify the Protestant policies of her father. So in the end, it kind of also acts as an end to the story of Henry VIII as well. She managed to keep a divided nation afloat, and even more or less steadied the rocking ship. Granted, she did this by being very aloof when it came to making hard decisions involving Mary. But her reign, at least the first two-thirds or so, was a time of unity within her government that would be lost during the reign of James. When the honeymoon period for the new king ended, Elizabeth's popularity experienced a broad resurgence among the citizens of England. And it's a popularity that has survived to this day. This idealized version of England, a strong government with a thriving theater scene, remains a perfect picture. No one talks about the Jacobean era, the reign of James VI and I, all that much unless you're studying it. But I'm sure we'll be talking about the Elizabethan era for many, many years to come. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show and tell a friend all about it. Next time, we're jumping across the English Channel to talk about another very famous historical queen, as well as her husband. It's the story of the downfall of King Louis XVI and Queen Marie Antoinette as the French Revolution threw France into a time of chaos. I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.